This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
All right, here we go. 6:12, Monday morning, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, but I think that's cliche. Instead, I'm going to go with, since yesterday was May the 4th and May the 4th be with you, I'm going to make today May the 5th be with you. May the 5th be with you, and you can make it a 5th of whatever you want. Dry, pleasant today, but the storm chances ramp up. According to Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana forecaster, Tuesday through Thursday, bringing the risk for heavy rain and street flooding. So be aware of that. Not that there's really anything you can do about it, but just, I guess, keep in the back of your mind. Nice today, highs of 82, sunny, less humid. Then tomorrow and through Thursday, a chance for showers, primarily Wednesday and Thursday. But I'm not sure that they have a handle on this, so it might rain hard, and when it does, the streets could flood. That's a hell of a thing to tell you, but I think that's about where we stand. Brian Taylor joins us now, our friend, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. His most recent book is Russia Politics, A Very Short Introduction. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Tommy?
I'm okay. So tell me about the book. That intrigues me, the title.
The book is part of a series that Oxford University Press puts out called Very Short Introductions, and there's a very short introduction to pretty much anything your listeners might want, from rock and roll to black holes to Shakespeare to whatever, and so I was asked to write the very short introduction to Russian politics, so it's a tiny little book. If you want a physical copy, it'll fit in your pocket. Lots of people I know read them on other platforms, but it tries to be an introduction to someone who wants to know more about Russia and Russian politics, but is kind of new to the topic.
I love that idea because I always like to learn about stuff, and life is not a picture, right? It's a still photograph. It's a motion picture of where we came from and how we got here. How did Russian politics and the U.S. specifically relations get to where they are today? If you can kind of give me a little thumbnail on it, Professor?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, obviously, but to get to the heart of it, there have been a variety of efforts since the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 to try and remake the U.S.-Russia relationship. There was a lot of hope when the Cold War ended that, you know, peace would break out and we would all get along and all of those sorts of things. Obviously, a lot has happened since then, and it hasn't worked out that way. And from my point of view, the thing that has broken the relationship most of all has been the Russian war against Ukraine, which started in 2014 when Russia annexed through military force the territory of Crimea. And then, of course, three plus years ago, it launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, one could step back and say there were things the U.S. did that also annoyed the Russians, and that's certainly true, but launching the biggest war in Europe since World War II certainly changed the tenor of the relationship between Russia and the U.S. and the West in general.
So when it comes to Crimea and Vladimir Putin in 2014, right? I think I got my year right, annexing Crimea. Gorbachev would never have done that under Reagan, right? So what changed with the relationship where Putin felt empowered to do that, because part of breaking up the Soviet Union, Crimea was part of breaking up the Soviet Union with Reagan and Gorbachev. Correct me if I just said something that hurt myself. I don't mean to, Professor.
Well, when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, it broke into 15 new states, two of which were Russia and Ukraine, but there were others as well that your listeners will have heard of, from Estonia to Georgia to Kazakhstan to whatever. Mm-hmm. But according to the boundaries that existed at the time, Crimea was part of Ukraine. And so those were its legitimate international boundaries. But some Russians, including Putin, felt that that wasn't fair and thought that Crimea should be given to Russia instead of to Ukraine. I don't think there's any legitimacy in that view under international law. They would point to some things in history, but, you know, history tells us lots of things. But the way the world order tends to work now is the borders on the map that are agreed to by the UN and by other countries are the ones we try and live by. Otherwise, it would create chaos. So I think the question of why Putin felt emboldened in 2014 to do what he did is simply that Ukraine at the time was relatively weak. It was outside any alliances, and Putin felt that, you know, he'd been distrusted and mistreated. And I think this was kind of an emotional reaction to a revolution that took place in Ukraine that changed the government from a pro-Russian one to a pro-Western one. And that's what ultimately precipitated his annexation of Crimea. And
so,
it started the war that we're sort of still seeing today in its first form.
All right, so Barack Obama was president then. What options did he have, either as the United States alone or with the UN? What could have been done at that point? And if anything had, what would have been the Russian response? And would we be where we are today?
Yeah, some things were done. I mean, the most obvious were a series of sanctions were put in place by the U.S. and its European allies on Russian finance and arms industry and energy industry. And it was condemned by the United Nations General Assembly. But no one felt like the U.S. or any other countries were in a position to go to war over this. And in fact, Ukraine at the time didn't even have the military wherewithal to try and resist very much when this happened in February 2014. It was only after Russia sort of expanded its operations in the southeastern part of Ukraine, an area that we know as the Donbas, that the war that started in 2014 sort of broke out. So what else could Obama have done? I think probably the main problem was there was a bit more of a return to business as usual than there should have been. And maybe more could have done to prepare Ukraine for what happened in 2022. Although the Obama administration and the first Trump administration would say, well, we did some things to help Ukraine get stronger. We did a lot of military training with Ukraine under President Trump in the first term. A decision was made to provide these anti-tank missiles called Javelins. So there were some things that were done. And if we look at how Ukraine did when Russia invaded in 2022, it did much better, obviously. And although Putin thought he was going to march into Kyiv and take it over in a couple of weeks, here we are more than 3 years later, and they've haven't moved that far in the last 2.5 years.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs, Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Most recent book, Russian Politics, A Very Short Introduction. It's part of the had it right in front of me here. A series of very short introductions as the computer screen refreshes and screws me over. But I'll tell you about it later. 620 traffic now, WWL.
I'll be buying one of them books from the Acadian Windows and Hurricane Shutters, WWL Traffic Center. I'm Joe Cardosi. The Bonnie Carey Spillway has no delays as you head in from Laplace. I-10 is also free and clear between Kenner and Metairie, and the causeway is looking good to and from the North Shore. No delays across the Twin Spans as you head in from Slidell, and smooth sailing through the Morrison Curve and across the high rise as well. As you head downtown from the east on I-10, you're moving fine all the way through the Claiborne flyover. The Pontchartrain Expressway is also free and clear as you head toward the CBD. moving in from the West Bank. Smooth sailing across the Crescent City connection, and you're seeing no delays in either direction across the Huey P. This morning's traffic is brought to you by Terminix.
626, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It's Very Short Introductions, a book series published by the Oxford University Press. Brian Taylor, our guest director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, wrote Russian Politics, a Very Short Introduction. Professor, so, you know, the last time Zelensky, the head of Ukraine, and Trump met in the Oval Office, it was ugly. Then they met again last week, as I understand it, at Pope Francis's funeral. What is the latest on ending the war in Ukraine? I guess maybe first off, we should say, what is the status of the war in Ukraine right now? Everybody still bombing each other?
Yeah, the war goes on as it has for 3+ years now. In fact, in some ways, Russian attacks on cities in Ukraine have increased over the past few months while these negotiations have been going on. So there's no real change in terms of the war, no major change. The fighting goes on every day. There's been a lot of talk, as your listeners know, about a possible ceasefire, and there were times when it looked like they might be close to some type of at least partial ceasefire, but none of that has taken place. And so, you know, we're well past the 24 hours President Trump said he would need to end the war, or more recently they were talking about a settlement by Easter or by the first 100 days, and we're past all those barriers now. So I think the real question is what's going to happen over the coming sort of month or so, and is the U.S. eventually going to walk away? But you're right to point out that the relationship between President Trump and President Zelensky looks a bit better than it did than in that famous Oval Office meeting at the end of February.
So when it comes to options, be it the United States or the world, if Russia says, no, we're going to keep fighting, if Russia can keep fighting Ukraine, do they have unlimited resources, or are they about out as well as Ukraine? Ukraine's being propped up by the United States. Russia's in it alone, or is China helping them, Professor?
So Russia does have the wherewithal to continue, at least for a while, I would say. They're not running out of men or money or military equipment yet. It is correct, as you note, that they get some help from a variety of countries. From China, it's mostly that China buys a lot of Russian oil, and they provide a lot of dual-use technologies that Russia can use to make weapons. Probably the biggest outside supporter is actually North Korea, which sent 12,000 troops to fight in the war and also provides as much as half of their artillery that Russia's using at the front lines. So Russia has a few supporters. Ukraine has a lot more supporters, not only the United States, but the entire NATO alliance and some other countries around the world have been providing military assistance and economic assistance. But of course, Ukraine's a smaller country than Russia, so this outside assistance is probably more important for Ukraine than the assistance Russia gets, although it's important on both sides. But
let me give you my
so
biggest
far,
I'm sorry,
yeah,
Professor, just my biggest fear in a minute that we have left is that Russia decides to either continue what they're doing in Ukraine or even advance and try to reclaim some more of the old Soviet Union. China backs them, and they stand fast, and they say, you know what, you want to go nuclear war, let's go nuclear war. At what point does the United States say, well, we're not going to do that, that's crazy, and do China and Russia get to do whatever they want, or are China and Russia that aligned against, could they be that aligned against the United States?
At the moment, they're not that aligned where I could imagine Russia and China sort of entering into a war with the U.S. or any other target together. I mean, they're so-called partners, but they're not military allies. So I would not expect that. I do think that we're still a long ways away from a settlement, unfortunately. Vladimir Putin isn't really interested in a deal. He's interested in what he would define as victory, which is the subjugation of Ukraine to Russian control. And your listeners probably remember Senator Kennedy said a few days ago that Putin has jacked around our president on every opportunity, and he suggested putting more pressure on Russia by making it harder for them to sell their oil, which I think would be a good thing for the U.S. to do at this point.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time and your insight. We'll take a break, come back, talk about trade deficits right now. Time for WWL First News. 6:45, 6:45, 7:00. You know, President Trump, a lot of people get their hair on fire over stuff that he says, and I'm hoping, I'm convinced that he says stuff just to get a reaction out of people, or he just speaks off the top of his head and it really means nothing. Sometimes presidents, years ago somebody asked me about Barack Obama, why he was so measured at a press conference. I said that's because, well, whatever a president says matters, his words matter. But I think with President Trump, he speaks so freely, I don't know if it's the same, if they carry the same weight anymore. And yesterday he told Kristen Welker, I think, with Meet the Press, that he didn't know if he had to obey the Constitution or follow the Constitution. I think that's something that he just, stuff like that, I know people get worried about it, but I think he just either doesn't understand the magnitude of the question or is tugging the chain of some people to see how they react. He also had this to say when she asked him about the economy and tariffs and recession and so forth. Obviously, everything's not okay, and I think he just sometimes says some stuff to say stuff. Tarak Hassan joins us, professor of economics at Boston University, to talk about trade deficits, tariffs, all that stuff. How you doing, professor?
Hi, good morning, Tommy.
Last time you...
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
You were on with us. You kind of predicted something that was going to happen that day, and it had to do with currency and how it's not just all about the tariffs, but there's a lot more to this than I tariff you, and then it costs the manufacturer so much that they start producing these products in America, correct?
Yes, correct.
Explain a little bit more about that, please, if you would, and where that could fit into all of this economic puzzle with recession or stock market growth, et cetera, because the economy is comprised of a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's right. And it looks like we're already heading for a recession, so things are not looking all that great. I guess the first thing I'd say is that the tariffs are not really designed to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. And the reason is simple. We're all sitting here waiting for them to go away. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it now looks increasingly like the administration is looking for an off-ramp. If I'm going to move a manufacturing plant to the United States, then I need to know that, you know, the incentives for me to do so have to be in place for, you know, decades. And we're all sitting here waiting for the tariffs to go away, maybe next week. So that's why manufacturers are certainly not moving production back to the U.S. The other thing that I was worried about a couple of weeks ago and that I'm still worried about is the role of the dollar and sort of the damage that all of this policy is doing to our ability to finance our very large budget deficit.
You need to explain that a little more and in layman's terms if you can, Professor, because we're not all professors of economics at Boston University, but you understand what I'm saying, if you can, how that factors into this, because it is a key part, and I think a lot of people skip over that.
Yeah, so I think maybe the most important thing to know about our trade deficit is that it arises not from unfairness, but it arises from the fact that Americans in general, and in particular the federal government, is spending a lot more than it's taking in. So if you look at the size of the federal budget deficit and you look at the size of the trade deficit, they're, you know, very comparable. And basically what that means is that the federal government is borrowing money from foreigners so that we have to pay less taxes today. And when you, I don't know what a delicate way of saying this is, when you kick the foreigners, you're kicking them in their private parts with these tariffs, they might not be willing to continue financing our budget deficit. And that will raise interest rates. And when it raises interest rates, the federal budget deficit doesn't look as sustainable as it once was. And also the cost of borrowing for everyone will go up. And that's something that often in other countries happens very quickly. It's not one of these things that, you know, sometimes economic changes take a long time. So right now we're going to be waiting for a couple of months about, like, for prices to go up. That's something that happens slowly. Interest rates typically change with a bang. And that's really the thing that we were most worried about. When it looks like the government is behaving in a very irresponsible way, foreigners can just turn off the tap.
Basically. Who That's finances, it. Who are we borrowing money from to avoid paying more taxes to service the debt that we have as a country?
Yeah, it's a little hard to say. So it's basically lots of people abroad. People often say it's China, but that's not actually really true. It's mainly foreign banks who like holding U.S. treasuries to conduct their daily business. Mm-hmm. So think about it this way. The dollar is not just our currency. It's also the currency used by lots and lots of people abroad. And what that basically enables us to do is to print T-bills, print government bonds, and print currency, literal currency, like $1 trillion of cash are circulating outside of the U.S. And they're used to basically settle payments between people in very far away places. So it's foreign banks and just foreign individuals who like using the dollar in their daily business. Now, if it looks like the dollar is a less stable currency, they're going to stop doing that. And that's basically, we're giving up an opportunity that we've gotten very used to, which is effectively what we're doing is we're printing pieces of paper. We're giving them to people abroad. They're giving us goods in return. And to an increasing degree.
Wait, let me pick it up there. We come back. Let me pick it up there. We come back, and we'll make it about Fred and Charlie. How about that? If we can do that, and maybe we'll understand it a little bit better about printing pieces of paper in exchange for goods, and then tie that into how that works with tariffs. Every tariff that has been collected so far, all of that money has gone to the U.S. Treasury. Is that accurate?
That's right. Okay. But that's not going to be. It's just a tax. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So for people that think that China's being punished or whomever, every tariff that has been collected that has been paid by people in America has gone to the U.S. Treasury, correct?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, the importer, the person who's importing a good into the U.S. pays the tariff, and that goes to the U.S. Treasury. That's right.
Just wanted to clear that up. 6:52 more. We come back 8 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 6:58, I'm in a hurry to get back to Tarak Hassan, professor of economics at Boston University. Professor, you're going to have to come back in the 9 o'clock hour central one day so we can just do this World Finance Econ 101, an introduction, if you will. I'm going to call an audible, forget the question I asked you. Somebody texted in. We all presume that the economy in China is rolling along and they have no problems. Tell me, if you will, what's the situation with the economy in China, and have the threat of, or have these tariffs affected the Chinese economy at all?
I think they're beginning to affect the economy in China. The Chinese have been through a lot in the last couple of years, so I'm not sure if that ranks like among their top concerns, but it's certainly, I do think the Chinese are worried. Maybe not as worried as U.S. businesses. The big difference is that as Americans, we've just picked a fight with the entire world. So we're 20% of GDP. The rest of the world is 80% of GDP. We've picked a tariff fight with everyone at once. The Chinese only have a tariff fight with us. So that's the big difference.
right. I appreciate your time, Professor. I hope we talk to you again soon and spend a lot of time on this and go into detail and take listeners' questions because it is very, very complicated stuff. We'll take a break. We come back. May is World Cancer Research Month. We're going to talk with Dr. Lucio Millay about where treatment stands now. He's with LSU. Then we're going to help you take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow, I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something...
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and get up to 50% off with minimum purchase. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Can't get enough baseball? Start streaming MLB Network today. Get up to 15 out-of-market games a week live on any device, plus 24/7 access to MLB Network's award-winning shows, including live game look-ins and exclusive player interviews. And hear live radio play-by-play from all 30 clubs with MLB at Bat. Enjoy the home of baseball from virtually anywhere. Plans start as low as $5.99 per month. Sign up now at MLBNetwork.com/stream. Available in the U.S. only. Blackout restriction applies. Visit MLB.com/subscribe for full terms and conditions.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Fridman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.